This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should love these movies.
But we'll decide for ourselves if they're right.
Come and join me, the movie dude Eric.
And me, Kent.
And I, the Johnno Lobster, as we look at classic and independent film.
Welcome to Art House Legends. This episode we're discussing Training Day, starring Denzel Washington, Ethan Hawke, Scott Glenn, Tom Berenger, Raymond J. Barry, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, and Macy Gray, directed by Anton Fuqua.
This podcast contains spoilers concerning this film. We strongly suggest that you have seen the movie before listening.
There may also be mild to harsh language. Listener discretion is advised.
That said, sit back and enjoy the show.
Gentlemen, I have to say something here. Even though I was technically the person that was the one pushing for Training Day, I really never expected to come back to this movie ever again. I didn't realize it until I started it up for this podcast. I hadn't seen this movie since I saw it in theaters.
In 2001.
Is it
2001, man. October 5th was the release date.
15 years.
That's right.
I'll be honest with you. The first time I saw the trailer, I was excited about this movie. This movie was, I don't know, just something about Denzel Washington playing this kind of like nasty, bad, good guy kind of thing. I was all excited. And of course, that epic line about King Kong sold me on seeing this movie. And strangely enough, as much as I liked the movie, I never came back to it. I feel like watching this movie for the first time in 15 years, I'm trying to kind of figure out why, because I really liked the movie when I saw it. When did you see this movie, or have you seen this movie before?
I have seen it for the first time this very afternoon, but I remember it when it came out, and I remember watching like the trailers and stuff for it and the ads play on TV. And then I remember seeing Denzel win Best Actor for this film. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of like disappeared, except for like a couple references. I think one in a Robot Chicken sketch that Kent shared with us. But yeah, I honestly kind of forgot about it.
It is funny because there are references out there to Training Day, but I guess for me it's just, yeah, I mean, it did kind of slip under the radar. It's one of those things like, oh yeah, that did win Denzel Washington his Oscar. And we're going to talk about that because, yeah, we're going to talk about that. Kent, have you seen this movie before?
I had not seen the movie before. It felt like I did, though, and I couldn't put my finger on it till I remembered the Robot Chicken sketch. And it was like, oh wait, they almost were it. It was just weird that it felt like I had seen it and I hadn't.
My lizard.
Because of a minute-long skit, which is, I don't know if that says something about the movie or not, but...
Well, this movie actually has a really strange afterlife. When the movie came out, it got pretty decent reviews. It definitely got a fresh rating. A lot of critics really kind of enjoyed it. The fans of Denzel Washington came out and drove. This, I think, was one of his highest grossing films that he had ever made. Anton Fuqua, who up to this point had only made The Replacement Killers, the only one that I remember that he made, and that didn't really impress me as a director. So Training Day was kind of a curiosity for me to see this particular movie, and we'll talk about what he does after this movie. Needless to say, he's had quite a few interesting choices. And then we have David Ayer. David Ayer has come a long way since Training Day. He used to be basically just that guy who wrote these really crazy, wacky scripts, and now he's directing movies based on his wacky, crazy scripts, including one later this year, kind of about some oddball bad guys doing a good thing.
And
strangely enough, he's competing against his director in Training Day about another bunch of oddball bad guys doing a good thing. That's kind of weird, but
those movies are
Antoine Fuqua is doing the remake of The Magnificent Seven,
right?
With I believe it's Denzel Washington and if I'm not correct, Dwayne Johnson is involved.
I think Chris Pratt too.
Yep, Chris Pratt. It's a Ethan, huge cast.
Ethan Hawke. So Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke are going to be in it.
Yeah.
And then David Ayer is directing Suicide Squad, a comic book movie.
Actually, it's my most anticipated comic movie this year.
Which that's saying something, because this is kind of like the year of ultimate comic book movies. You've got Deadpool open this weekend, huge. Batman versus Superman, Captain America Civil War, which is the story that I've been waiting for the Marvel movies to do. So, I mean, and don't forget like X-Men Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. That's crazy stuff. But Training Day, did you know that CBS just short ordered a series based on it?
I heard, but this is also the same television studio that also was going to do Beverly Hills Cop, and that didn't happen. So I'm going to wait until I actually see a pilot for
CBS. CBS has gotten in the business lately of picking up movies and turning them into TV series, like they just did Limitless. Which, if you've seen Limitless, you're like, how are they going to make that into a movie, especially for CBS? And they did it, and it's actually pretty decent. So
I'll leave it to your opinion on that.
It'll be interesting to see. And they're also the Person of Interest network. So
yes.
it would be kind of interesting to see Training Day as a TV series.
Let's not mention Person of Interest right now and how CBS is dealing with that. I'm a little upset about that. But anyway, let's talk about Training Day, the movie that we're here for, because
my man, Denzel Washington.
This is our first Denzel.
And
if we would have done Boyhood like I was hoping to last year, this would have been our second Ethan Hawke. But no, it's going to be Training Day that we're going to be discussing here.
Hawkman.
I'm going to say the cast list here. There's so many interesting casting choices here. I mean, Tom Berenger, I think this is like the only thing he's done besides Inception in the last 15 years. We have Scott Glenn, who we talked about in Silence of the Lambs, resting on his laurels here. Raymond J. Berry, which we talked about just last Christmas on The Ref. He was the sheriff. You know, now he's playing a scumbag, kind of like how I know him from Justified. So that's kind of awesome. And then earlier this month, we talked about Common. We talked about John Legend. Did you ever expect that we'd be discussing a movie with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg?
Snoop Dogg? Well, I figured eventually we'd find Snoop Dogg in something.
Yeah, he shows up in a lot of things, but this is...
But in an art house movie?
I don't know if this qualifies as art house, because it does...
Well, it's a classic now.
It does go the blockbuster cop thriller route a little bit, and it kind of... And we'll talk about kind of how it goes from character study to action movie. Mm-hmm. and kind of plays with those tropes. But, yeah, so Snoop Dogg shows up. You've got Tuco Salamanca from Breaking Bad in there.
You have to understand, me and Raymond Cruz have gone a long way. The first time I saw him was in Clear and Present Danger, and ever since, he has been that guy and that thing for me.
Right, right.
Even up to now, I mean, anytime I see him, I mean, he's played everything. He's played Marines, he's played good guys, he's played bad guys, he's played short or small, quiet characters, and then big, bombastic characters. He does everything. And so it's just, you know, when people call him Hector, or, you know, Salamanca, it's like, that's just a small portion of his work. And I mean, he's not, you know, an Oscar winner, but at the same time, he's that guy that I notice and that I, you know, whenever I see him on screen, I get really happy. And we're going to talk about that scene in detail because, oh, hell yeah. I'm sorry. That entire sequence is easily the best in the film, and we'll talk about it. But
you've got Cliff Curtis, the man of 1,000 ethnicities.
Yes. And
Macy Gray.
Yes.
A very, very small role from one of my an actor from one of my favorite comedies, Terry Crews.
Mm-hmm. Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I love Brooklyn Nine-Nine. But I mean, it's It's kind of one of those movies.
Well,
It's a Hollywood movie. It's set in L.A., and they kind of just get a little bit of everybody in there. And
but how many of you noticed Frank Kranz? I'm curious. How many of you noticed?
Yes. Yes. He was in the car at the very beginning, one of the stoners.
Yeah, he was one of the stoners. It's like, part of me is just going, man, whatever you do, don't go out to that cabin in the woods.
I just wanted somebody to say, the schnozberries taste like schnozberries. Little super troopers.
Yes, yes. Oh, man. Anyway, so, yeah, let's talk because there is a lot here to discuss. In fact, there's a lot here more than I thought that there was going to be. In fact, I thought this was probably going to be a small episode. I don't think so anymore. But, all right, so, okay, so first off, I have to talk about the format. I love what is called the 24-hour movie, which is the events that happen over a very short span of time, usually between hours, but up to a day. And Training Day, even the title basically just tells you this is going to be a very short amount of time, and we're going to see events that are going to take place in this time that is going to affect the characters. Are y'all familiar with this type of format, and do you have any specific favorites of this format? Because I love this format.
It's used in TV quite a bit.
Well, I mean, it became very prominent in the early aughts with, like, 24.
Yeah, I mean... And it's a lot of times it'll be more of a I think of almost more of a comedy kind of trope. Like I'm thinking of like Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller, like,
yes.
Like movies that take place in a day. They tell a contained story in one period. But yeah, their use in thrillers and action movies can be quite compelling as well.
What about you, Ken? Or do you have any particular favorite 24-hour movies or movies that kind of have that format?
Well, I was trying... Yeah, mine is kind of blanking on the format. The only thing I can think of is, like, Weekend at Bernie's, which is more like 48 hours.
Well,
same
concept. That's kind of in the same realm.
Or in some ways, Aliens, because, you know, once... the reactor starts going critical, we only have this much time. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's more of a ticking clock type scenario, but I understand where you're coming from.
Blanking right now.
No, it's okay. The thing about the 24-hour movie that I love is it having that constriction and being contained within a very small amount of time or space has this way of forcing writers and filmmakers to really determine what information is important, because you're not going to hit all the notes. You're going to have to find unique ways to tell the story outside of that 24 hours in a unique way. We had Die Hard, which is another 24-hour thriller. It happens over the course of one night. And the way that information is doled out gives us the backstory, but it gives it in a unique way. And Training Day is in the same realm. For us, we need to understand who Jake Hoyt is, who he is as a character. We need to know who Alonzo Harris is. We have to understand where all these players come from. And we have a whole lot of players, which is the thing. And we have to get that information out in a unique and interesting way and propel the story and propel the day as it goes along. That said, I will say, though, considering some of the insert shots that Fuqua puts in here, I'm starting to wonder if the universe of Training Day has a hopping sun, because apparently it decides to go back and forth like a ping pong ball throughout the day.
That's one of the technical constraints to doing a film, and obviously we know it takes several weeks to several months to shoot a movie.
That's true. But
I mean, I know the weather in LA doesn't change that much, but at the same point,
shadows.
You know, it's funny, actually. I just thought of one of my favorite movies that uses this, but it's also set in LA. Falling Down with Michael Douglas, which is pretty much like a guy's worst day, but. That uses the same, it's told over a 24-hour period.
Well,
we should talk about that movie.
We will. Now that you brought it up, it's going on the list. I want to talk about Falling Down because it's the one Joel Schumacher movie I don't think anyone will disagree deserves the praise it gets. That said, with Training Day, it's not the shadows being in different spots. It's that there's insert shots of like morning or evening that are clearly set in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
And that was really confusing. Like, why did you put that shot there? Why do you have the sun coming up? It's already like 11 o'clock in the day if we're kind of following the chronology of the events. I mean, I don't think that it takes that long for the sun to rise in Los Angeles. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's the case.
But it's a different universe. So.
I'm starting to think that maybe this isn't 24 hours. I think that his day actually was like more like 70 hours at this point.
Well, he did some drugs. He had, you know, he got hit on the head a couple times.
That's true.
We're not actually sure, you know.
Okay, so one of the greatest things for me when it comes to 24 hour movies is we get cold open. Right? Jake Hoyt, we see that he's a family man. This is a training day. You know, it's his interview to join this extremely elite narcotics unit. He's really excited. He's heard enough of good stuff. He is an LAPD, which already, let's just put it this way. If we had done this movie for Chinatown, maybe we weren't so casual that wouldn't have fired off alarms right away to the extent of the insanity that will ensue. How many of you did think of Chinatown watching this movie? I'm curious.
I didn't, actually.
What?
Did it? Yes. Yeah, because...
All the corruption and all the abuse of power, but it's abuse of power
in a different way.
How
which I think
it's showing the abuse as it's happening.
You have three wise men who are clearly, you know, higher up echelon conspirators to fix crimes. So
right,
that...
but they abuse power in a very different way from Denzel Washington's character. Denzel abuses the power of the badge and
They're doing the same thing though. It's just without having to flash the badge. They're so
right, but
high,
they're not face to face with their victims. Denzel is dirty. Like he's dirty and getting his hands dirty.
Well, one of the things
though he likes to make other people pull the trigger for him.
Well, that's one of the things, like this, and you kind of brought it up yourself. These are guys that used to do what Denzel does. They trained Denzel to do that so that they don't have to do that, and Denzel's training other people to do that so he doesn't have to do that. This is a cycle of violence. This is a perpetual corruption that's going on over and over and over again. And, you know, and I think it's very interesting that, and I think that the film is outwardly saying something regarding race about this, considering that over half of Alonzo's unit is multi-ethnic. And all of them are out for number one. All of them are out to get their piece of the pie. Greed is what really unites them. And anyone that could affect that greed is an enemy, no matter what their skin color. But are y'all getting that kind of some of these same elements, or that, you know, that the corruption is perpetual, that this is a cycle, and that's, you know, that training days happen all the time, that this is just one in a series that happened?
Well, obviously, at some point, he had to have trained the other members of his squad.
And do you think he used the same tactic?
I'm not sure if he killed anyone on those previous ones, but I bet a lot of it was the same.
Actually,
what we find out is this isn't a normal day of his life, because the night before, he killed a Russian mobster in Las Vegas, and so in addition to...
No, he didn't kill him. He roughed him up really badly and made him look loose face with his...
No, they said beat him to death.
Oh, I thought it was just really bad, because the whole point was that he made this guy look bad, so they want money for him. But okay, I could be wrong on that. I'm not going to bet my reputation on that.
No, he killed the guy, and so the settlement, in order to make things, because he's a cop, and so I don't think the Russian mafia necessarily wants to kill a cop, so they tell him he needs to give them $1 million to make things right, or else he will get killed, and they'll just kind of deal with that. But so it you kind of, and again, you find out this later, like you get the backstory later, but it's not necessarily a typical day for him as well.
But do you also think that perhaps that in a way, these types of training days that Alonzo's doing, he kind of tailors them. He picks the day that they happen. He uses them to his advantage. We find out that he basically coordinated all of this stuff in order to force Hoyt into this particular reputation, even down to the point that he picked Hoyt because of his clean look. You know, that they couldn't pick someone that even had a shade of dirt on them, otherwise no one, especially killing a cop or an ex-cop, would bring their whole house of cards down. They had to have someone that had a squeaky clean reputation to do it in order to pull this thing off. Harris is so good at coordinating this stuff. I'm sorry, I don't believe that this is his first time. Maybe his first time to have to put so much trust in someone that he clearly can't trust. That party forced his hand. I have a feeling like if anyone else had done what they had did, what he did during that day, they would have been dead long before then. They would have been killed or sent packing or, you know, have their reputation torn apart before lunchtime. Because you get the sense that there are times when you could tell he just wants to kill this kid. He just wants to kill him. And he can't because he has to use him. But that's kind of what I'm getting from all this.
Then after he's used him, he just drops him off people who he hopes will kill him.
Yeah.
Well, I think that in a way, this is a training day in the sense that if he would have gone along with it, if he would have taken the money, if he would have shown to be trustworthy, he would have been part of the unit. In fact, I have a feeling, like, again, Harris was wanting to move up into the Wiseman position. You know, it's him going from Jedi Knight to Jedi Master. And he needs a replacement. And none of his guys have leadership skills. We see them. They bicker, they argue, they need someone to lead them. Hoyt is capable of making on-the-fly decisions. He has a strong sense of morality, which we'll argue this, but Alonzo also has a twisted yet profound sense of morality.
Street justice.
Yes. He's definitely a social Darwinist at heart. And part of that you could probably say is that he's seen more than he'll ever tell, and he believes that the whole thing is going to tear itself apart, so why tear yourself apart in the process? And you got to give it to Denzel's performance on this, because this character could have just easily just been extremely flamboyant and spouting off platitudes and have no weight behind him. And it's Denzel that's giving this guy this kind of cunning, this kind of brilliance, charisma, tons of charisma, right? I mean...
Well, it's Denzel Washington.
Well, that's true. But even Denzel, and let's be honest here, there's been times when Denzel couldn't pull off some of the charisma that...
Couldn't save the movie.
Yeah. I'm seeing Courage Under Fire, seriously. I mean, that was just horrible.
There you go.
But just the year before he did Remember the Titans, which is another I think it's fair to say that it's a sports classic now.
Right. Yeah. Remember the Titans, definitely. This is through the 90s, Denzel owned the 90s, right? We almost talked about it. Instead, Glory. Yeah.
Glory was 88, and then Jungle Fever, then Malcolm X. After Malcolm X, it was bread and butter from that point. He became Denzel, as Tom Hanks put it. You know, he did Philadelphia at that point. He did do, he was able to pick his projects and.
Oh, yeah, right. Absolutely.
You know, but
then he kind of became a staple of the thriller genre after he kind of like moved out of dramas. There was Fallen, The Siege, The Bone Collector. And then I feel like this was kind of like the culmination of that. And I think this one is kind of where he elevated a typical thriller to an Academy Award winning thriller through his performance.
What about you, Ken? What do you think about the whole Denzel situation?
Mystique. Yeah.
Yes. I love it. Denzel Mystique. There you go.
The evolution of the Denzel Mystique. That's hard to tell. I mean, I just remember one day people just being, women just being like, ooh, Denzel. I'm like, okay, I know he's an actor. I know he's been in a lot of stuff. And I just don't know where it just came from. So, I mean, he's, My God, he's been in it for ages.
And another movie that he was nominated for just a couple years prior was also The Hurricane, which I feel like kind of also need to mention as well, as a performance that, again, one thing that Denzel specifically is really good at is giving us characters that probably aren't the most likable, but we're interested in them anyway. We feel for their characters. I mean, in Philadelphia, he plays a homophobic lawyer who has to go through this journey with a gay colleague that's suing his old law firm. And that transition is, his transition feels earnest because of Denzel's performance. You know, Training Day, and again, I feel like Denzel has built up this credit with the audience of being this good guy, that he's cashing in on it with this movie, right? Because in a way he's saying, look, I'm Denzel. I'm kind of the good guy. I might not be the nicest guy, but
you can trust me. Yeah.
and to come out swinging and just little at a time come and just tear that kind of reputation apart and giving us a character.
There was an old review of a Denzel Washington movie, and I want to say it was for The Mighty Quinn. But whenever he smiles, you hear that cha-ching of the cash register, kind of like, okay, that's where the money gets made.
Yeah. I mean, another actor that did the exact same thing was Forrest Whitaker when he did Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland. We've never seen Forrest play a sociopath. And so when you see him smile and sweet and aw shucks, we remembered the Forrest Whitaker of, you know, nice guy. And then to go full on, full psycho, it just, you step back. And for Denzel, this is exactly what he did for Training Day. But, I mean, even from the first moment that we see him, right, you know, reading his newspaper. I'm curious, Did Quentin Tarantino take a stab at the screenplay? Because the diner scene feels a lot like Tarantino, right?
Well, I mean, David Ayer has to be a Tarantino fan, right?
Well, he does. Well, I think that he's definitely of the same cloth as a writer when it comes to doing these types of films. Now, bear in mind, David Ayer over the after Training Day has tried to recapture this insanity in movies like Harsh Times, where you try to see Christian Bale play a Latino really badly, in my opinion. he did Street Kings, where you're supposed to believe in a corrupt cop, Keanu Reeves. I guess he was going full Bodhi on that one. So
End of Watch, that feels very much like this kind of a film.
Oh, that's him as a director, though.
He wrote it, too.
Yeah, he did write it, but the thing is that End of Watch as a screenplay is decent. And I understand, I love End of Watch, but for me, that was him coming out as a director. That was his saying, look, this is the kind of stuff I direct, and this is stuff that that I can do. And in a way, now he is a rival for Antoine Fuqua when it comes to these types of movies. And
I guess what's kind of funny is when we were talking about this film, I made a joke that I preferred the other 2001 LA-based undercover cop movie, referencing The Fast and the Furious.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not realize that David Ayer also worked on the screenplay for that as well.
Yeah. And Hector was in that movie. The guy who played Hector in Fast and Furious was also in this movie. His name is Nola Guglielmi.
Yeah. But anyway, I didn't even realize that he worked on that script because I didn't have an association with David Ayer to the Fast and the Furious. But I wonder if he did a draft.
And to tie it all back to Bodhi, Fast and Furious was kind of a ripoff of Point Break.
Right, exactly. So I guess for me it was I was just kind of like comparing the two movies in my head, but and obviously both kind of play with the gray area and the morality and kind of like the street justice aspect of it. And I think one does a good job making you see both of the characters' sides, And then you kind of like find the common ground. And this one, you just kind of go the opposite direction. And so they kind of like start with common ground. And the more they learn about each other, the more, you know, you realize that there is no common ground and it's not going to turn out well.
You put it best. I'm sorry. That was the best. I have never heard anyone put it as good as that. And you're right. Exactly right. Yeah, at first, you know, here they, I mean, even the first conversation is about, you know, we're both cops, so tell me a cop story. And from that point on, the more that they know each about each other, their worlds are so completely different. And I love the fact that throughout the film, it does show you glimpses of, you know, the average street cop doing his job. You hear sirens in the background. You know that they're not going to affect any change. They're just mopping up the blood. Right, they're changing the tire on the freeway. They're not, you know, they're not getting the bus. They're not getting the thing. And we're constantly asking ourselves, is the means justifying the ends? Is Alonzo Harris's so-called reputation, his so-called conviction rate, his so-called expertise, is he actually making progressive changes and actually helping things, or is that all just bullshit?
It feels more like he's securing his own power base. It's all it feels like he's doing.
Well, I mean, especially coming after the facts, you know, that we're in the age after the Shield, and there's clear ties between Training Day and the Shield, right? In the way that we're seeing corrupt cops as kind of both the good and the bad guy, or the bad guys, but we're kind of following them. You know, we're seeing kind of long game type plays, and you could say that Alonzo and Roger were friends, or that Roger was Alonzo's mentor. But at the same time, considering what we know about Harris, especially as we go along, we know that this guy does play long games. This guy can, in fact, control his urges to whack some people in order to get the outcome that he wants. That he does kind of see people as just meat, right? That they fill a purpose. Once that purpose is done, I have no more use, right?
Well, yeah, okay. So I see what you're trying to say. There's kind of like the weird other side of it, too, which is he's kind of like a Robin Hood. Or maybe that's...
I mean, hated by the peasants, perhaps.
But he's showing up with the blender and the DVD player and stuff. The Sunni, I loved that. When you saw the label on the CD player, it says Sunni. Mm-hmm. but like, yeah, he's like, oh, you know, we're just trying to help out the families and stuff like that. So is that just his ego that he thinks if he roughs up the bad guys and like gives candy to the kids, that makes him a good guy and it makes up for the bad stuff that he does do?
Does he honestly think that he's the good guy though? I don't think he gives a shit.
Yeah.
I don't think he cares if someone sees him as the good guy or the bad guy. I think he just cares about doing the job. I think that what he sees is, you are scum. I don't care if I can tell that you're scum right now or if I can prove you're scum right now, but you're scum, and I'm eventually just going to bust you. You know, I think that he's one of those, he is portraying this cop that's one of those that everyone's a suspect, no matter what. You know, the 5-year-old that's going to school is packing a piece in Alonzo's world. You know, you see a baby, that baby's going to grow up to be a gangbanger in his world. You know, just his, you know, the way he looks down on the world, the way he looks down on society. And especially when we see his world, the question I have is he justified in thinking that way? And I guess that's the question I'm asking. Is he justified in believing that everybody is scum, considering all the scum that he sees?
Well, this is kind of, we're kind of getting into the heart of darkness of LA crime stories, which is, this is a recurring theme, whether it's this or Chinatown or I think one of the great shows in the last decade or so, Southland, or one of the great cop shows, mm-hmm. of the last whatever. And so this is kind of like a recurring theme, right? So obviously, to serve and protect. Well, if you look at these, you know, these neighborhoods and these people, they're all they're all involved with the gangs, or they're all involved with crime, some way or other, right? And so you kind of get the what Alonzo presents is, well, why are we going to bust like the small time weed dealers when we can kind of like bring them into the fold? They can make a little bit of money, but then if something big's going to go down, we can find out about it ahead of time and just, you know, deal with the one percenters, if you will. You know what I mean? Like the real drug lords and stuff like that. We can go after them and not worry about like the small time people. And what are you going to do anyway? You know, put them in the revolving door of the incarceration system.
Well, I mean, at the very end of the movie, he had no problems threatening an entire block of people of getting raped in Pelican Bay. I mean, he had no qualms throwing
that
kind of
weight
around.
You hear him. You hear him quote repeatedly, like his arrest record and how many people he's put away, and what was it like? 1,500 man years of incarceration or something like that.
15,000.
15,000 man years of incarceration.
I wanted to do the math. I'll be honest here. After you said that, I wanted to do the math. Like, how many people did he infect?
Right, yeah. If you just divide it by life sentences, right? You know, 25 to life or something like that.
But at the same time, can we also say that what Alonzo's doing with his boasting is he's kind of giving his hip-hop cred?
Right, and you don't ever see him book anybody in the film.
He talks about the, you know, going after the big guys. Do we ever see a big guy? I mean, with the exception of Roger, but come on, let's be honest here.
Well, I think we see the three wise men. And
but is he going after them, or is he wanting
to
come?
No, because they're the big guys. He's the big guy. I think that ultimately, in the universe of the film, the crime that exists in LA exists because they allow it to exist because it profits them. It benefits them. And this is kind of almost like a social critique as well. Does it behoove those in power to have a populace that is addicted to drugs, that is impoverished, that is, basically can live or die by, the whim of the police. So doesn't that then benefit those that are in power? You know, your three wise men, if you will. Alonzo is basically their enforcer on the street. He keeps them afraid of the police. He keeps them, under the thumb of those in power and allows enough, corruption and crime to go on, because if the streets were clean and everybody was happy and safe, then they wouldn't need the stick, you know. And he's kind of the tip of the spear, if you will, going out and making everyone afraid of the badge.
Ken, what do you think of Alonzo? Do you see him as kind of being kind of a brutish Robin Hood type, or do you see him being a source of the problem?
He's not Robin Hood. He's the Sheriff of Nottingham. He's been given a directive from somebody that's corrupt. He follows in with corruption. Everybody doesn't like him. He's more profiting off of the badge. And
even the guy whose son or whose nephew he saves from a long jail term sentence as soon as he's out of earshot is talking about how he hates the guy. It's like...
I think there was something beneficial about not sending him to jail at that point.
Maybe Lobster does have something about this whole, maybe he's trying to make himself feel like he's somehow better than...
Well, I think that's a part of it, because there's... Okay, so is it better to be feared or loved? What's the answer?
Depends.
If you're Alonzo, I don't think there's a difference.
No, it's both. You want to be both feared and loved. So he does try to have it both ways. He tries to put fear in the hearts of everybody that's around him, but he kind of couches it in he's helping everyone. He's doing good things for the community. And I think that's why at the end everyone turns their back on him, because he has kind of built this image for himself of himself that he is the Robin Hood of the community and he is doing good things for everybody. And because he shows up with stolen appliances and stuff like that, and he's kind of like buying goodwill among the community. But at the same time, it's not, they're not respecting him out of love. They're respecting him out of fear and what he represents.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like he, I mean, the type of respect that he's trying to garner, he really doesn't give much of a care about, though.
No, he does. I'm not saying that he cares about them. He cares about himself, and he wants everyone to give him deference and respect. So in order to accomplish that, he pretends to be their friend and, you know, pretends to care for them and wants, you know, kind of like presents the image that he is doing good things for the community. But at the same time, the way that he's accomplishing it is more through fear than through actually earning the respect of the people.
Got a point. All right, can we talk about Captain Stupid as Hell? Ethan Hawke. Because, my God, how many bad decisions can one officer make in a 24-hour period and not be on a slab? Seriously, this guy is the dumbest police officer I've ever seen in a movie. And I'm putting him up against the police academy types.
It's like he didn't have a street beat before he went into this group.
I don't even find him as a black and white.
He had a street beat, but it was in the valley.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, and they make jokes about, like, go back to Starbucks, right? So,
you should know that.
In the valley, the porn place? I mean, shouldn't it be, you know?
No, we're talking about like the Valley Girl, like the San Fernando.
Yeah,
the
San
Valley.
Fernando, that's the place where all the porn is made.
Well, I mean, yeah, that too.
Probably slightly more law abiding.
But he's like the cop. He's like the sheriff of Burbank, right? Like,
yeah,
like he gets called in to what did he say? What was his story? He pulled over a DUI. Like, that's the most action he's gotten is he pulled over a DUI and the guy, like, happened to have guns in the car or whatever. But they're not that it wasn't that's not somebody from his neighborhood. That was just somebody driving through.
Yeah. Well, it's just like I'm comparing this character to another fresh off the beat cop, which is Brad Pitt's character in Seven. And the thing is that particular character, even though he was fresh, felt like he actually had done a beat. You know, the way he talks is like he's done time on the on the streets. He knows his way around crime scenes. Ethan Hawke's character, if he would have said, I just graduated from police academy, I would still have problems believing he actually attended. Like, this guy, it's like he knows nothing about not just the beat, but, you know, here you are, you're wanting to be a part of this rough and tumble narcotics unit. And almost from minute one, they practically tell you, look, we go outside the bounds of the law. And he's always surprised when they do this. I mean, he had you smoke PCP within the first hour of meeting you. And you're surprised that he's taking drug money?
He didn't tell you it was PCP. The implication I had was that it was just pot.
Well, no, he told him that it was pot. But even within that first hour, he tells him that he made him smoke PCP. He couldn't wait long enough to be honest about what he made him do. It's like, yeah, he told him it was pot to begin with, but as soon as he took it, it's like, oh, I didn't know that you're taking that you're a pipehead. I mean, that's the, you know, that right there should have told you, get out of the frickin' car and run as fast and as far away as possible. You're not up for this. I'm sorry. It's like, you know. I mean, he actually makes, you know, Captain America seem like Batman in comparison when it comes to being overly sentimental.
He's a Boy Scout. Let's be honest.
Boy Scouts are calling him names. I'm sorry. No, don't insult Boy Scouts.
Yes, they're much more worldly than he. But
there are Mormons who have more street cred than this kid.
Yes. But okay, so his path to He's upwardly career mobile, right? Like that's, and he says it to his wife, and he's like, you know, if I get in this, and then, you know, soon I'll have my own division. And he's upwardly mobile in the Force. And so he sees this as kind of like his path to, getting a big promotion and a big raise down the line. And so when Alonzo is like, okay, here's what I want you to do. He wants to impress Alonzo. He knows that his career, in the Force that he's chosen for himself is riding on what Alonzo thinks of him.
Well, can we compare him then to Clarice Starling, who's kind of in the same position when she takes the position under Scott Glenn, where there was a clear indicator that he might actually make her sleep with him in order to rise up the ranks of the FBI, even though it doesn't actually happen like that, but the implication is there, even to the point where Hannibal Lecter even calls it out. Can we compare those two characters and how world? I mean, again, even Clarice Starling kind of understands how the world works, vastly more informed than Ethan Hawke's character. And we're supposed to believe that Ethan Hawke is younger than Clarice Starling, which I'm sorry, but yes, Ethan Hawke doesn't age, but I'm not buying that he's like a mid 20s, you know, straight off the beat. You can't sell me on that. Sorry.
I think in late 20s, but even then, late 20s would be like...
That's being extremely nice for Ethan Hawke.
Right.
I'm sorry. We've been watching him throughout the 90s.
I know.
The early... Hell, he was in Dead Poets Society, for crying out loud. No one is buying the fact that he's supposedly this super young cop. You know, I mean, there are people on Harris's team that look younger than Ethan Hawke. In fact, even Dr. Dre looked younger than Ethan Hawke.
There you go.
Sorry, I'm ripping on this kid. I'm sorry. It's like, it's the character. It's not Ethan Hawke. I mean, Ethan Hawke's trying his best, but for crying out loud, you know, at the time they needed to have a younger actor playing this part.
So, do you think that? I read an article recently about Ethan Hawke, and kind of the gist of the article was that Ethan Hawke is one of those actors who his job is to make other people or other things look good. And it kind of used the example of Training Day, meaning that Ethan Hawke is really there to give a showcase to Denzel and not necessarily to really be a fully fleshed out character of his own. He's more to represent, again, like we said, like the antithesis of Denzel's character, and then give Denzel something to act off of. If this movie was about just Denzel's character going around, and again, one can imagine having pretty much the same day. He owes money to the Russians. He's under a lot of pressure. He's gotta come up with this cash and use his resources and whatnot. If the movie was just about his character, it wouldn't be anywhere near as engaging without someone for him to play off of, right?
Well, yes and no. The problem is that even during this particular time, Ethan Hawke had been doing indie films where he was playing main lead. And especially with Richard Linklater in his Before trilogy, which he had done one prior to this, and he was doing another at the same time that he was doing Training Day, where he is the main protagonist of those particular films. And so for Training Day, yeah, he is kind of playing the cooler, so to say. But the problem is that it needed to be a character that was even more of a blank slate than Ethan Hawke. Because Ethan Hawke, as much as he isn't exactly one of the greatest actors of all time, he still has some natural charisma.
Well, I'm not saying he's a bad actor.
No,
I'm saying that
the character needed to be a complete blank slate.
Yeah,
we should not have any baggage coming into this movie about who Jay Coyte is. He, in a way, he needed to be either an unknown or someone that that we would kind of, you know, brush our shoulders off of.
Let's flip it around and say Paul Walker or somebody like that. Like let's flip the script literally.
If it was Paul Walker, that would have been perfect. I'll be honest here. Paul Walker would have been a better choice than Ethan Hawke, because again, he is a blank slate. He's a more of a big blank slate than Ethan Hawke. And honestly, the more I think about it, Ethan Hawke would have been better for Fast and Furious, you know, especially in...
What are you saying? No, I'm just
yeah.
Swap the actors.
I said it. I mean, hell, both movies have Letty in it, so let's just say... I mean, not the actress Letty, the character named Letty.
That is...
So I'm starting to wonder if perhaps I think David Ayer just, Xeroxed...
Like Letty's, yeah.
Well, I think he Xeroxed the Training Day script for Fast and Furious, and it's like he Xeroxed it and then goes, you know what, this looks too much like Training Day, let's throw some Point Break in it.
Let's have more cars.
but I just want to be clear, Michelle Rodriguez better than Eva Mendes.
Oh, I love me some Michelle Rodriguez. That said, a very young Eva Mendes, not bad to look at. Thankfully, she didn't have a whole lot of screen time, because I will go out and say that she's, again, not one of the great actresses.
Yeah, this movie isn't kind to its female characters, I will say. There's really only three actual, well, if you count Macy Gray's character, four female characters in the story.
The first time I saw it, I didn't realize that was Macy Gray.
I didn't either. And maybe because her speaking voice isn't quite the same as her...
She doesn't sound like Donald Duck? Oh,
her very distinctive singing voice.
I love Macy Gray's music, but let's be honest,
I do. She has a voice that is unique. And what, around this time, she was also cameoing in Spider-Man, mm-hmm. I think?
Yep. Well, or she'll be in Spider-Man the next year. It's just, I mean, the amount of music stars who make cameos here. Obviously, Anton Fuqua did the whole Michael Bay thing and pulled everybody he could from his music videos. Period. To make this or to kind of give some extra scenes. And I think it took a whole lot of convincing. Going, hey, you're gonna have a scene with Denzel Washington. You know, it's like as soon as they say that, it's like, okay, I'm in. And yeah, all of them have Denzel Washington scenes, if you notice. Not one of them is strictly, Ethan Hawke. It's like, that was the way he convinced them. It was like, hey, you want a scene with Denzel? All right, come and do a cameo.
Huh, that's funny.
But, yeah. But the character is just so stupid. I mean, we're not talking about just, like, movie stupid. We're talking about, like, Darwin Awards stupid. It's like... Oh, man.
I'll play advocate for a second and go.
Go ahead.
Just, I could see for half of the day him just being scared and going, okay, whatever. This is basically one long interview and whatever. I just go ahead and go with the flow and whatever he says, do. And don't question it because it's a different world than what I've been in.
Okay, if the valley is that crime-free that basically they're all their police officers are Pollyannas, let me move to the valley. I mean, for crying out loud, I thought that Beverly Hills probably has more crime than the valley in comparison. I mean, you know, yeah, they'll mistake a banana in the tailpipe, but at least they bring their guns and like actually do things. You know, I'm starting to wonder if Valley police officers basically just, you know, have little, like, hug watches or something.
Well, and then right at the beginning, you find out that he was trained by a female police officer. Yeah. And so right at the beginning, the kind of, like, sexist card gets played, which, you know, if it was a woman that trained him, then he clearly couldn't have learned how to be a good cop.
Here's my question when it comes to the sexism. Did anyone else have a hard time hearing Denzel say this stuff about liquor license? It's like, even now, you know, and I've seen a fair share of him playing some, you know, rather rough guys. But even now, it's like, dude, that's Denzel Washington. That's like hearing John Wayne talk about them evil Japs. Like, you know.
But again, I think it's kind of interesting looking at when the film was made, because they mention Rodney King. And so that was kind of like the antecedent in... Los Angeles race relations to this film. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at what the current dialogue is about the police and race relations, it's very, very different. But at the same time, it deals with the same theme that this film addresses, which is kind of like the abuse of power and the negligent attitude towards human life, and kind of the attitude that everybody is guilty until proven innocent. So shoot first, ask questions later.
Well, you just inadvertently brought up the question that needs to be asked. Why make Alonzo Harris black? Because if especially considering that it's definitely treading on the idea of LAPD being a racist and destructive force, and this does not paint the LAPD in a very positive light at all, with the exception of the one cop that's like helping the lady with her tire on the freeway. We don't get a whole lot of pro-LAPD aspects here. No one is buying any kind of niceness from LAPD. Hell, even when the one cop did his job and saved someone from being raped, he was still going to get killed. That's just how much that the LAPD is hated in this film. So why make Alonzo African American? Why make him the race I can't believe I forgot his name. Rodney King. Why make him the race of Rodney King?
Well, I think you could kind of go the big route, which is to say thematically the themes of the film, that corruption knows no color, and that anyone can be corrupt, anyone can be crooked cop, anybody can be a supposed upstanding member of the community, and at the same time just in it for themselves and looking for personal gain. You can also kind of say that because he is a member of supposedly the victimized class, he should have more of a circumspect attitude towards policing, right? But he doesn't. He's totally about being the top man, being the top dog, using his badge as a bludgeoning instrument rather than a shield and something that represents something good. And then, you know, you can kind of make the argument that to get where he is in the LAPD, maybe he had to make those compromises to get a literal seat at the table with the three wise men.
Yeah, but they don't ever have any overt racist things that they say. The closest that we get is that someone makes a joke about a snail, which they're actually talking about an actual fucking snail. The thing is,
yeah.
I mean, this is kind of weird because, again, the film is definitely wanting you to, again, by throwing out the references of how our image isn't really good, there's a lot more scrutiny on us, definitely pulling to Rodney King specifically, but not putting in racist elements, with the exception of someone calling, which is weird, it's like the only racist epithets are actually put against Jake. You know,
a lot of racism
is thrown out against him.
My lizard, except he doesn't say lizard.
Yeah.
So.
Well, not even just that. I mean, you know, how many times does he call white boy or milk toast or, some sort of derogative term for his ethnicity?
Right.
I mean, they make more derogatory things about his skin color than they do about his age. Which, considering that, you know, that you would have thought that since he is supposedly this young cop, that they would be making more of it about him being a rookie or, kind of not having any, not having the adequate skills. They do make a couple of those things, but not to the extent of white boy.
Well, I mean, and I think to kind of like come back around to your original question, which is why make the lead character and the antagonist of the film, why make him black? How else are you going to get Denzel Washington in your movie other than to give him the lead? We haven't really talked about the fact that Antoine Fuqua is also black, mm-hmm. And that it makes sense for an up and coming director who wants to make his mark on Hollywood, but still wants to have a diverse cast. Mm-hmm. I think that is, you know, kind of another explanation. But I think the way that the film does play with race a little bit, and again, it doesn't do it in that overt of a way. And so when we get to the end of the film, you have Alonzo's people turning their back on him. And so you can take people in a couple different ways, right? So on the one hand, they're the people of the neighborhood that we kind of assume that he grew up in. We assume that he came from these streets too, and at one point decided to become a police officer and not a gangster.
But is there any difference between those in Alonzo Harris?
No, not the way that he does it, and you kind of wonder if he made the decision to be a police officer because he knew that badge would protect him in a way.
Well, it did him much good.
Did not do him much good at the end. No. However,
and it was white people that killed him.
I kind of think that there's a flawed ending to the film, and kind of a missed opportunity to end the film thematically.
Okay. Don't go into the ending just yet, because I do want to ask what you thought the ending should be.
Okay.
But I want to give Kent a chance to chime in, because he has been kind of quiet.
Well, on the original question, why does Harris have to be...
Or why did they make Alonzo Harris black?
Well, he could either, from a viewpoint of where his character is living, he has to be some sort of minority. He could have been Latino, and it could have worked the same. But, because, let's face it, a white guy doing what he's doing in that community is dead in a week.
Now, out of curiosity, have either one of you seen a movie directed by Dennis Hopper called Colors with Robert Duvall and Sean Penn?
I think I've heard of it.
I know, I haven't seen it.
It was made in 1989. It's about a rookie cop who is under the wings of an older cop who is trying to teach him the ways of the street. The older cop in this case being Robert Duvall. And in fact, during one of Harris's more profound diatribes, it did remind me of Robert Duvall's saying about the about bulls. Bulls and cows, which I'm not going to do because only he can really do it justice. So YouTube it if you get a chance. But the thing is that...
Or is it about smiles and cries? Because that was a little something that went absolutely nowhere.
That was the Richard Linklater moment right there. That was when I was like, did they just decide to go away from Tarantino and did Linklater? Because that was a Linklater quote, if there ever was one. It was like, sorry. It's like I'm starting to wonder if maybe that was like an ad lib from Ethan Hawke, because that was like, oh wow, that was bad. That was like
smiles
really,
and
really
cries.
Bad. Oh man.
All right. So what's left to talk about with this?
I want to talk about the scene. You know what scene I'm talking about? The one that is practically if I ever see Training Day again, this is the scene that I'm always going to think about. This is a scene that I thought about. When I think about this movie, this is the only scene that really comes to mind. And it's when Alonzo finally gets what he wants from Jake, and he takes him to Sniper's house. Cliff Curtis, Raymond Cruz, and leaves him there and sets it up so that these guys would kill Jake. This scene, from the moment they get there to the very end of the scene, is the best pacing that I've ever seen in an Anton Fuqua film. And we'll talk about the editing, because I didn't realize that they had the legendary Conrad Buff editing this film. And if you want to see a list of the most amazingly edited films, just check out Conrad Buff's filmography. He is one of the best. This is one of the best paced, one of the most tense moments in the film. Because in a way, what the film got right in this scene was, we understood that Alonzo Harris is Jake's pass. Nothing's going to happen to Jake as long as Alonzo's there, right? No matter how Alonzo feels about it, anytime that someone tries to do anything to Jake, Alonzo stops it, right? So when Alonzo is gone, and the moment that Sniper opens his phone and he reads the text, and we don't know what the text is. That, again, is brilliant. We don't know what the text is, but he looks at it, he looks at Jake, and you know something is wrong. Something really wrong is about to happen. And what happens after that is incredible. I mean, just the pacing, the tension, the way that the scene plays out, the terror, Raymond Cruz just going full Tuco, I have to say it right now. I think he out Tucos himself in this. Let's be honest here. I mean, he's jumping up and down. He's like doing his surfer voice thing.
Yeah.
You know, just going full out crazy. He's like, you could tell that this guy, he's not a psychopath, but you get the sense that he could turn on the crazy, right? He could easily go full Tuco.
Well, I mean, you could talk him down a little bit. You can make him see reason, and instead of cutting somebody's legs off or killing them, he could just break their legs.
Yeah, I mean, but again, it's like the way that this character is just like full on crazy is like you could sense that he would love nothing more than to drown this cop.
Just don't call his grandmother a biznatch. I'm just gonna keep dropping Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul references because
yes
that is my frame of reference for this actor. So
I agree. Although if you really want to see a completely different side, watch him in The Closer, where he's like this very soft-spoken detective.
That probably makes him scarier though.
No, he's just sweet and kind. He doesn't. He's almost feels harmless in the Closer or the three seasons that I've seen of it. And he's playing off of Kira Sedgwick and J.K. Simmons. So.
Well, this is one instance where something that happened earlier in the film actually pays off, which does not happen a lot in this film.
Well, and it's his good Samaritan side.
Right. It's like the one time that he was kind of a good cop, except in probably a like not a very good way. But he did one good thing the entire day, and that turns around and saves him.
He did the one good thing in the entire damn movie.
Yeah.
Okay, let's be honest here. No one else does a good thing in this movie. Not one person.
I could argue the Russians do a good thing at the end, but...
Well, it's not because of a sense of justice, let's put it that way. And let's be honest here, Jake is now kind of a bad guy, considering that we don't know exactly what happens to that money. You know, that money does go missing at the end. And I don't think that he's turning it in.
He can go back to writing Tickets in the Valley and not worry about his kid's college education.
That's true. I don't see him turning that in. That would be more a headache. And he'd have to ask more, or he'd have to answer more questions than I think he wants to. Or at least... Although I have to admit, though, now that I think about it, because we don't know what happens the next day. Again, one of the great things about a 24-hour movie, it's up to us what happens the next day. So if he does, in fact, turn it in, he goes to prison because they automatically assume that he's involved with Harris's gang. They're going to look for some sort of fall guy, and his baby is going to grow up in welfare until he decides to become a cop, and the cycle begins again.
Cycle continues. Well, what's interesting is the TV series is, I believe, going to be...
A continuation?
Yeah, a continuation set 15 years later.
So it
could be interesting to see what.
So Jake is now a part of the Three Wise Men.
I mean, it could be. it would just be interesting, I guess, to see where they take it. I know that Antoine Fuqua is involved in the TV series as well. So
all I hope is that we get to see Snoop Dogg in a wheelchair again.
Maybe they fixed him. You know.
Yeah, it's a bionic chronic. Yeah, that's
bionic. Yeah.
Yeah, I somehow have a feeling that I just gave Kevin Smith his next comic book idea right there. Sorry, the Bionic Chronic. Okay, anyway, but no, that scene is perfect. I mean, and I love how, again, when he calls up Letty and wanting to know if she, you know, she skipped school, that's tense. Like, you're like, you know, because you could see that she would say no, or, you know, that she would try to save herself, but part of you is like going, tell him the truth. You know, it's like, and it's just the buildup is just so good in the way that they released it, and the fact that they let him go and basically set up the last act right there, right? Because from that point on, Jake is out to kick Alonzo's ass. Right?
Yeah, and then the movie devolves into action thriller territory.
All right, so I'm curious, what do you see as being the better ending for this film? Because I hope that the Tenpenny moment still happens for any of you people who play Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Okay, so leaving him there in the cul-de-sac.
Do you think that they should have killed him, or, you know, like beat him to a bloody pulp? Finally saying that we're not afraid of you. You know, you're mortal.
Yeah. I kind of just wanted to leave it there. Like, you see everyone close around him, and you see Jake go home to his wife.
That would have worked.
And that would have been it. That's all you would have needed to end the film. And unfortunately, they introduced the whole thing with the Russians, which I don't think this film needed. I don't think this film needed that plot device to set up why Alonzo had to make a big score that day. I think it would have been more interesting if it was just something that came up in the course of events and he had the opportunity to make a big score and went for it. And then he was kind of saddled with Jake because it was his training day as kind of a liability. So he had to figure out how to like involve Jake, but also like keep him not involved.
So you wouldn't actually want to re-edit, or you wouldn't want to reshoot the film. You would want to just re-edit the film.
Yeah, I would want to tweak it a little bit. So things happen a little bit more organically. You could still have Scott Glenn's character in there. You could still have everybody in the movie who's in it. Maybe center it on the three wise men a little bit more and the case that they're kind of working on. You could still have the crunchy peanut butter story in there. And then
long as there's more Tom Berenger, that's all I'm going to say.
I mean, you could kind of involve it more in the LA world and not have like this external thing with the Russians, which I that's like the one thing that really didn't fit to me in the film. Because you're making a movie about LA, LA gangs, LA people. You don't really need this external thing. And then they kind of have to set up the end where the Russians have to show up and then kill them.
Well, here's the thing, and I think I understand what David Ayer was going for specifically with the Russians, is that obviously no one in this town scares Alonzo. There's, you know, this town, his town is so connected that he's got layers upon layers that is going to protect him. The only way that you would be able to get him in a position of vulnerability is if it was an outside source. And so what they did was that they decided to put him at odds with the Russian mob. Because apparently the Russian mob doesn't have connections to Los Angeles.
Just Vegas, baby. Just Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, when I think Vegas, I think Russians. What can I say?
So kind of like the other thing that goes along with that is you find out that the reason why Alonzo is in trouble is he was basically just being Alonzo, which is not taking shit from everybody and thinking he's invincible. So he beats this Russian courier to death, and now the Russian mob is after him. Mm-hmm. I think you could have worked that in organically to a more LA based story, and so maybe you still could have had that threat. But I mean, ultimately, it is his hubris that brings him down. It just has nothing to do with the Russians. The Russians find him, but he's already been defeated. He's already lost all of his armor has been stripped off at this point. Mm-hmm.
I was just hoping that the ending would have had some reason as to why his son was on Thorazine. I'm sorry, that kid was... I don't want to say that the actor was slow, but let's be honest here. That kid...
like the gunshots are going off around him, and he's just like, I want my mom.
And he doesn't.
Yeah, he's been playing a little too much Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, actually.
No, that wasn't Grand Theft Auto. That's Thorazine. That's like Walking Dead type thing.
So, I guess, the ending disappointed me in that I just didn't feel like you needed the Russians to show up at the end and kill him. Because, again, like, he was done when Jake walked away from him in the hood.
Well, when this one Jake walked away is when the community that he's been ruling with an iron fist turned their back on him. Like, we don't care.
I saw them more as closing in on him, and then that's like the final shot.
And then you
get Jake, Jake goes home to his family with a big bag of money under the bed or something.
At the same time, especially considering the threat about Pelican Bay, I'm sorry, it's just like, do we really want to see the community basically turn into the animals that he thinks that they are? Or is it better that they basically are no longer afraid of him? That, again, kind of like Freddy Krueger, his menace has no power over them anymore. Like, we're done with you.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess
fuck yourself.
I mean, the other thing that they could have done was bring the Russians more into the plot. If you kind of got the sense during the film that the Russians were following him, if you saw him looking over his shoulder at any point.
Or Peter Stormare,
running with some giant scissors.
That's Malibu.
We're gonna cut off your Johnson. If they could have brought them in more and maybe had them show up in the showdown at the end, almost like Enemy of the State style, where you have like the two factions who have nothing to do with each other but both have a vendetta against the main character, kind of like show up at the end and then end up shooting it out against each other, maybe something like that. But to me, it felt unnecessary to have him gunned down at the end. And I don't think it was as emotionally satisfying as the director and the writer wanted it to be.
I understand. What do you think, Kent?
And he'd already been shot in the ass, for heaven's sake. How else can you humiliate?
Yeah, how does he drive without
being exactly, yeah.
shot in the ass like that?
Because he's that hardcore, okay? And he's always prepared. He has a donut in the back as well.
If you've seen the Book of Eli, he can drive blind. It's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
I was hoping we would go the entire episode without mentioning that piece of garbage.
Oh. Yeah, I'm still confused how he got out of the cul-de-sac, and I was even watching it. It's like, how do you get out of there alive?
Well, yeah, and I don't think really the car is drivable.
Considering that they made such a big deal, is that one way in, one way out, is just like you set up that territory where it should have ended there. You know what? You know what I think it is? I have a feeling that in fact that was the actual ending, and that there was studio interference. We can't have him
unless,
in like that.
Like, the only way he's going out alive is if they run him out on a rail. You know what I mean? Like,
you know what I just thought? It's like, I could see why a studio wouldn't want that to happen, because basically you'd probably have rights groups going that, so the black people are just animal kill anybody because they don't like them. I could see them being concerned of how the film would be portrayed. So it's better to have Russian mobsters kill you. Because if you think about it, all the mobster stuff really doesn't tie into the rest of the film.
No.
It really does feel like kind of like a thing that was done in post. That they just added it in.
It gives you a motivation for why he wants the money. Gives you an external threat that gives, a reason for him to be afraid and be desperate.
But that's only, again, through snippets of dialogue that could have easily been done in post-production. We know for a fact that he's cold-hearted enough that he would kill anybody just because he felt like it. There's no reason to believe that he wouldn't just kill his mentor simply because, the scorpion and the frog situations. I could honestly, now that you really brought it up, I honestly think that that was really the way it was supposed to end.
And I, after looking at IMDb and all their problems, continuity errors with the very ending.
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
One of them that kind of makes sense as a oops, grab the car. And yeah. Even though it's supposed to be beat the hell out of.
Yeah.
I'm
waiting for the CinemaSin for Training Day, and you know it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
The only one I disagree with is they keep saying, "Well, why wasn't the woman freaking out?" I think she was part of it.
Oh, she was absolutely part of it.
I can see her being in Vegas.
She pulled up, ID'd him, and then backed up and trapped his car.
Yeah.
So that the Russian mob could pull up and put the hit on him.
And if they're worried, why don't you hear her scream? Well, if they're being very careful not to hit her.
Yeah, they're not shooting at her car. They're shooting down
into her. Yeah, she's a
spotter. And she's maneuvered the block in the back, so. Well, why is the car behind? Because she's blocking them.
Yeah.
No, that's the same kind of pincer movement that we see in The Usual Suspects. So, yeah, that's right. All right, at this point, I think we kind of went over all the... Actually, we didn't go through all the Geek Sheet stuff.
Right, but I mean, like, you can... Like, obviously, Ethan Hawke shows up in a bunch of stuff. Denzel himself is a walking Geek Sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the bit players, again, have shown up in a ton of stuff.
Well, I mean, Cliff Curtis is the guy that's on Fear the Walking Dead
right now. Right now, he's in Fear the Walking Dead. He's done a ton of stuff.
I do want to bring up Nick Chinlan, who plays the other white guy on Harris's crew. He's the guy who threatens the bunny on Con Air.
Okay.
He is one of the head honchos on Chronicles of Riddick. He's done practically every TV show that's ever been produced within the last 15 years. Everything from Buffy the Vampire Slayer to 24 to Hell, Human Target with Rorschach.
I love that show.
Yeah, that should got a raw deal in my opinion. Hell, he's the voice of Crusher on Young Justice, nice. And Quan Chi in Mortal Kombat. So yeah, I've heard of his name, but
yeah, and so Antoine Fuqua again. Like I feel like we have to mention just a couple of the other films he's directed because he has kind of made his bread and butter with. This genre, obviously not none of his other films have really been what you would call Oscar bait. I think this one stands alone among the crop of movies that he's done, and I think just by dint of people felt that it was about time that Denzel get a lead Oscar.
But Southpaw, if it weren't for Creed, Southpaw would have been making Oscar glory right now.
That would have been the big boxing movie of the year.
Yeah, that's definitely it was all Creed's fault.
It was all Creed's fault.
It's always Creed's fault. But
yeah.
No, I mean, when it comes to Antoine Fuqua, and I can't believe I think I've seen every single one of his movies.
Right. I mean, he did. You mentioned Tears of the Sun, which I remember seeing. He did King Arthur. He did Shooter, which is actually pretty good. Olympus Has Fallen, which is getting a sequel.
Yeah, which he's not a part of.
Right, which he's not because he's doing Magnificent Seven. Olympus Has Fallen is pretty good.
You know, I take that back. Repenting the Killers didn't approach, I didn't like, but in 2000 he did Bait with Jamie Foxx, which is actually pretty good, if I may say so. Now, it's understand this is back in when Jamie Foxx was trying to be funny, but Bait's actually a really interesting kind of spy thriller in the same area as like Enemy of the State. So I would recommend that one.
Right.
But
yeah, I guess what's interesting is like the next logical film for him is King Arthur, which does, I mean, I'm like, okay, so you're kind of making this your thing, but yeah, let's do this. Obviously King Arthur
it's Jerry Bruckheimer. When Jerry Bruckheimer calls, right. You answer.
Yeah, you answer. King Arthur got panned. And then I was thinking about this movie and I was thinking about possibly one of my favorite Denzel Washington cop movies, Inside Man, mm-hmm. Directed by Spike Lee, which I absolutely love that movie.
I do too.
And then I was thinking about Clive Owen, who's in that. And then I was thinking, what if Denzel played King Arthur and how awesome that would be. And then I started.
Considering they play Julius Caesar, to me, it's like we can make that
look. Yeah. So, and then I was thinking, what if that had been the movie? What if they had made King Arthur with Denzel and made less blockbustery spectacle, but more like more scenery chewing and stuff? That would have been pretty good.
And it might have been that Denzel was the director's pick because Denzel had a good working relationship with the Bruckheimer Simpson at that point.
Yeah. The Siege, right? That was a big. Wasn't that one?
No, that he did Crimson Tide.
Oh, Crimson Tide
with Jerry Bruckheimer. He had done was the one with Deja Vu, the one with time travel element. Sucked. Don't see that one. Period. Don't. It's awful. But the thing is that Fuqua's films, for the most part, and I'll go ahead and I'll say it, they suck. A lot of them suck. And it's not because he's a bad director. It's just that they're just so boring.
Sure.
You mentioned Shooter. Shooter's interesting for like 20 minutes. And then the rest of the movie is just basically a guy that's cleaning his gun. Literally.
Because then I'm going to shoot her. Just kidding.
But, no, I mean, The Equalizer, which was quite a bit of fun, it was definitely a lot more exciting than it had any right to be. But then again, I'm a fan of the old 80s show, so I will admit that my bias is going to come out there. As for Magnificent Seven, with the cast that they've got, I'm definitely interested in it. But I'll tell you right now, I am way more interested in David Ayer's Suicide Squad.
Suicide Squad, yeah.
Than I am with Fuqua. And it's simply because with Ayer, even the bad movies that he's made, they're insanely bad. They're so bad you have to kind of see them to realize just how awful they are. And, you know, and that's not just his writing, but his directing as well. He's not a boring director. So, you know, when I heard that he was doing Suicide Squad, to me, that was perfect. That was peanut butter and chocolate coming together. It just made sense.
Or peanut butter and ass crack.
Don't ever say that again. At least you didn't bring up the nut. But, yes. I went there. No, but
you'd have to be nuts to try that. You know what I mean?
Har. You had to. I know.
Listen, it's obligatory. I got to bring the pun game.
All right. Well, at this time, let's go ahead and let's end it because this is turning into a way longer episode than even I was expecting.
Yeah, than it deserves.
All right. So, Kent Lobster, do you agree with the critics and the Oscar voters on Training Day? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent.
Oh, you know, the problem I have this film is it didn't grab me like I expected it to grab me. And then, yeah, there's a lot of these little problems that just start adding up. And then the big problem of how just not with it certain characters are. Jake. that just kind of, I can't pass it. I don't feel like totally condemning it because there are some really, there's some nice speech, short speeches and just nice general idea going on. But it's just wasn't my cup of tea, so I have to maybe it for reasons. So
reasons,
yeah, all these reasons.
All right, Lobster.
Yeah. All right, it's gonna be a maybe from me as well, and I think I kind of spelled out my feelings in our discussion. To kind of reiterate, I feel like this film doesn't really add anything to the cop genre. And it really doesn't say anything interesting about the dynamic between the police, the community, the, you know, kind of like the various factions. It flirts with those ideas. And so I feel like maybe a different screenwriter or a different director would have been able to hone in on those and sharpen them and add more weight to what already are pretty decent performances. From Denzel especially and deserving, I think, of the acclaim that this got. I think really any film that he is in, he does elevate. And I think this is a case of he elevates it just enough. And there's just enough good material there that he can really make something of it. And at the same time, it elevates the film which would otherwise be pretty mediocre. Like if you cast, again, if you cast a different person as his character, I just don't see it. I don't really see it reaching the level of what he was able to do with this. So it's a maybe for me. I don't really have much more to say than that. So.
Okay, well, I made a mention that of a lot of the stuff I really like about this film. I love the 24-hour format. I love the scene at Sniper's Place. That said, a lot of this film is meh. A lot of it is meh. It's really just held together by Denzel Washington's performance. One of the things that I found interesting about the aftermath of Training Day is the fact that when after a couple of years, the critics who were all for this slowly turned around and they weren't as on board with this film as before. And I think part of it is because it doesn't hold up. It's one of those films that is pretty unique because, again, we weren't expecting Denzel Washington to play such a heavy. And on top of that, his charisma makes this film a lot better simply just because of what he's doing. But the direction isn't as impeccable. And as we see, this is possibly the best that Fuqua is capable of doing. And that's fine because he's a capable director. This film had no right to be considered an Oscar contender. Denzel Washington's performance is good, but to me, it upsets me that he gets his best actor win here after he had done Malcolm X, after Remember the Titans, after The Hurricane. In The Hurricane and Malcolm X, he got nominated for Best Actor in those. He didn't win for those. And those were vastly superior performances. And I would even go so far as to say Remember the Titans was a vastly superior performance. And hell, I mean, and maybe we'll do Remember the Titans this year or next when we do a sports movie. But that character had all the all the stuff that we admired about what he did with Alonzo Harris's character, without the inconsistency that character had. But at the same time, I really do. I like the movie. I do. I like this movie, and I'll watch it again in 15 years, I guess. But that isn't what we're asking here. The question is, did it deserve the claim that it got? Did it deserve the Oscar that it got? And the answer is no, it didn't. But it's not a bad movie. So I'm going to go ahead and maybe it myself. Simply because it is a good movie in the sense that it does what it's intended to do. And people put way more on this than it had any right to put on. It was a good movie, but it's not a great movie.
If the show does end up going to screen, will you check it out?
I might give the pilot a shot, but I'll be honest here. It's got to be on the level of, like, The Shield for me to be interested in going further with the episode outside of the pilot. Simply because there's way too many other shows that I haven't been able to keep up with. I would have a hard time being able to justify being interested in Training Day. But what about you, Ken?
All depends on when, how accessible it is. I don't know if it's one of those things I'm going to hunt down if it's only available through questionable sites.
If it's on CBS, it's going to have to be accessible to the geriatric crowd because that's who watches CBS. They will have to come up with a way to make it a non-serialized police procedural.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a short series, they might be able to do it as a.
Given CBS, it'll probably have like 5 episodes before being sold.
Maybe it's, but if it, as long as they make the pilot and they go ahead and order the series.
Yeah,
they make the pilot and then can it right there. And
well,
then
I'm, that's what for that's. The, that's the problem when it comes to Training Day on CBS specifically. People give Fox a lot of crap. At least Fox is willing to try stuff outside their wheelhouse. Right. CBS is notorious for if it doesn't meet a certain criteria right off the bat, chop and block, gone. They'll keep a show around for 20 freaking years. As long as people keep coming back to it.
CSI, NCIS, they'll keep making spinoffs.
Well, I mean, hell, look at Big Bang Theory. It should have ended 3 years ago.
You watch any of those, and it's like, Wait, which one is this again? It does not matter. It does not matter.
And remember that they were the first one to have the longest running primetime show with MASH.
Yes.
They kept that thing along four times longer than the war it was posting about. So that gives you an idea of CBS's model. And I seriously doubt that Corrupt Cops is going to be something that their audience is going to come around on.
Well, and especially NBC just tried it with Shades of Blue, which I don't feel like was a big hit for them, even though they put a lot of money into getting, I think, Jennifer Lopez on board and Ray Liotta, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ray Liotta.
So I feel like that's territory that's been trodden. Now, if you told me Showtime or HBO or even FX was doing their take on Training Day, that might be worth tuning in, but I don't feel like we're going to see anything revolutionary on like network TV.
The only way that I would be excited about an HBO version of Training Day is if they got the guys from The Wire doing it. If they did that, I would be their opening episode and curious to see what they do with it. Because that crew could do something interesting with Training Day, although it would probably divert far, far away from the TV show within like two episodes. And for all the right reasons, in my opinion. But like I said, primetime TV on network.
Even like True Detective territory, I feel like wasn't the last season of True Detective set in L.A.?
It was.
And did it quite do it justice?
I like, again, I'm the contrarian. I actually like the second season. So, yeah, it's one of those things, like, I can understand why people got mad.
Yeah.
Because
it wasn't season one.
Well, no, it wasn't season one. And they were ambitious, and they tried some different things, and not all of it worked, I'll admit it, but it's not for a lack of trying,
right.
Which is something that I admire a lot more about that. And who knows, if the Training Day TV show shows to actually be doing something, then I might be interested. But I have a strange feeling that it's probably going to get like five episodes before getting kicked off CBS, and they might air the rest on like AMC or relieve the contract.
All right. I feel like we have said what we need to say about Training Day.
Yes.
And let's...
What was your verdict then?
Oh, we were maybe.
Maybe.
This is a mediocre showing for Training Day.
Yes. But I have a feeling that we're going to be saying very different things about our next pick, which I have a feeling neither of you have seen before.
No, I have not seen this one. I have I've kind of been aware of it, and I've wanted to watch it for a while. So The Last Emperor.
Yes, Bernardo Bertolucci telling a saga of the Chinese emperorship of the late 19th century.
This will be fun.
This is going to be very exciting, not just because we will finally get to some Italian cinema, which is something that I feel like we've sorely been lacking on, but we're also going to be discussing one of the most unique Best Picture winners of the last 40 years. So I can't wait to talk about it.
Let's do it.
So that's our next and the last episode of our Oscar series for getting back to the business as usual. But I have to say our March is turning out to be one very exciting month, and I hope that you'll join us for that as well. If you have anything to say about the episode, please feel free to let us know on our Facebook page as well as our Twitter account at Arthouse Legends, or you can just send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com. And thank you so much for joining us on this ride.
But, ride along, so to speak.
Yes, and if this was your first episode, I hope that the Training Day didn't do too much on you. But were there any other questions or anything y'all want to bring up before we go?
Nope.
All right. Well, at this time, this is the Movie Date Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is John Lobster.
And Fiend.
Thank you for listening. If you want to leave us feedback, go to gunnageek.com and you will find all of our contact information and other shows. The music heard on this podcast is by Kevin MacLeod and can be found at incompetech.com. The opinions heard on this podcast are those of the individual host and do not represent Legend Stream Canada or Gunna Geek. No infringement is intended.